Welcome to episode 3 of the Cyber Guy podcast. I'm your host, retired FBI Special Agent Darren Mott. In this episode, I'll discuss the history of the cyber threat and how the FBI evolved to become the lead investigative agency in the United States investigating cybercrime matters. So before I get into this little history lesson, I want to thank everyone who's taken the time to download and listen and provide me comments on this podcast. I appreciate your patience as I work through some of the kinks and ironing out a more fluid nature of what I'm talking about in these podcasts. In the coming weeks, I will talk to fellow retired and current FBI agents about cybercrime matters that they've worked in the past. Some of those will be things I'll talk about in this particular podcast, because this podcast is designed to give you kind of an overview of how the FBI came to deal with cyber matters. It wasn't, obviously, in the 1980s, cyber was not a big thing. The FBI didn't really concern themselves so much with it. However, as time evolved, then the FBI had to evolve with that in order to deal with the wide array of problems that were caused or that came to be because of the invention of the internet, the use of home computers, and the burgeoning e-commerce community that exists today. But before I get into that, I want to give you a quick little current cybersecurity item, especially for those folks who have kids doing school from home. So obviously with COVID-19 and social distancing and schools having a hybrid in-class and at-home model, one thing to be aware of if you're a parent dealing with this is that there has been an increase, a large increase in cybercrime activity surrounding people doing school from home. So the FBI Cyber Division and the Internet Crime Complaint Center, which is a division of the FBI, released a report yesterday that reported a 300% increase in cybercrime activity, including a 273% increase in large-scale data breaches since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so a lot of this can be attributed to not just school from home, but work from home, obviously, is a big issue, as I've talked about in episode 1, I believe, in that you are creating a larger attack surface from which cyber actors can find vulnerable computers, compromise them, and then use the connections those computers have back to the networks to which they are reporting. It can give them access to those networks. So, for example, if I want information from a school district, if I can compromise a teacher or a student's home computer, I can then use that computer potentially to get into the school network and steal personal identifiable information, maybe do a business email compromise, crime where I can get someone to pretend to have to pay a particular invoice and send money over. There's a lot of different things that can be done as you increase the number of available devices to be attacked. It's no longer just the school network that has to protect itself. It's the school network has to protect itself and protect the students and the teachers that are using outside appliances to connect to those school networks. So a couple things to keep in mind of when you are, if you're dealing with this, is read the app reviews on App Store or the Google Play Store, depending on if you have iPhone or Android type devices, Chromebook, things like that, and make sure that the apps are legitimate. There's a lot of malicious applications that slip through the cracks in both Apple and Google's App Store community. So you want to make sure that if you or your child is downloading an app that only has like 2 reviews, then you want to maybe think about holding off on that, because there may be something malicious associated with that application that increases your risk at home. Because all of this that I talk about is how do you reduce the risk to you and your family and your business to not become a cyber victim. You're never going to eliminate the risk, because as long as you have a computer, it's connected to the internet, there are actors out there looking to compromise vulnerabilities in the devices, the applications, the hardware, the software that we use to connect to the world, and they are looking for those exploits so they can get access to the information on your machine or use that to go to another area. So just, again, be aware of that. Your goal here is to reduce the risk. If you want more information on this, you can go to IC3. That's the letter I, the letter C, and the number 3.gov, and there is a threat report on this. The FBI also suggests avoiding posting links to teleconferences on public chat rooms and social media posts, because there's been a huge increase in what's called Zoom bombing. Everybody's using Zoom as their online communication platform as they do schooling and things like that. People getting access to these Zoom meetings, and then they're going in and posting pornography and doing other things that you really don't want in your Zoom meeting. So just be cognizant of that. Put your settings on Zoom to private if you can. Add a password that makes it harder for folks to get in. Again, whatever you can do to reduce the risk. So now for the rest of this podcast, I want to talk about the cyber threat, how the FBI came to work cyber matters, how it's changed over time. I'm not going to go over every single cyber case that the FBI has ever worked. Probably if you are a fellow FBI agent who's retired or understands a cyber threat, you're going to wonder why I missed out on stuff. I'm not focusing on every single thing, just kind of giving a general understanding of how the FBI evolved to deal with cyber matters, just like the cyber threat has evolved in over time from what it was in 1988 when the first person was convicted of a cyber crime to where we are today, where nation state actors and all sorts of other things are going on. You can hardly keep control. You can't keep control of any of it, but it's hard to stay on top of all of the bad things that is happening when it involves a cyber threat. So let's start off with in the 1980s. So obviously the 1980s, the internet was first getting going. There were 1988, there were about 600,000 computers that made up what at that time was the internet. And so there was a researcher, his name was Robert Morris. He wrote some code to see how it would impact the newly nascent internet. And it ended up creating a denial of service attack against 10% of the computers online at the time, which basically caused that particular network to stop working, essentially. He was ultimately identified. He tried to hide his crime. He didn't come out and say, hey, I made this mistake. Oops, sorry about it. He didn't do it intentionally. It was a mistake. However, in 1986, the Congress had passed the Computer Crime and Fraud Abuse Act, which was, I will say this for politicians, they were at least trying to be ahead of the problem instead of behind it as they usually are. But so there was a cybercrime statute. It's Title 18, Section 1030. If you are a lawyer or you're a legal buff and want to look that up, essentially, if someone has unauthorized access to a computer network, you can be tried under this particular statute. And for the most of the cases I'll probably talk about here, Title 18, Section 1030 is largely the statute that is used. It's been used for going on 32 years now, and so it's still effective today. It hasn't been modified a lot over time. It's been changed a little bit, but still the primary statute that's used to convict folks that do a lot of these cyber crimes. So anyway, Robert Morris was arrested. He was the first person convicted under this particular statute. He got 3 years probation, 400 hours community service, a $10,000 fine, and computer infamy. The name of that particular case, again, was the Morris Worm. It's the first one. Now, people argue that wasn't really the first one, but it was the first one where someone was actually convicted under that particular computer crime statute. So that was 1988. So then the 1990s roll around, and I remember this time very well. I was a high school teacher, newly married. In the early 90s, got my first computer. I believe it was a Hewlett-Packard, or a Packard Bell, actually, a Packard Bell computer. And you could go online by using Prodigy, CompuServe, things like that. In this early time frame, the genius of Al Gore had not created the valuable internet to which we now have come to love. But at the time, the internet was present. You could do a lot of text message boards and things like that. And one of the big online scams that started around this time was the internet chain letter, where you would go online and say, hey, here's five people's addresses, put a dollar in each one, send it to those people. They'll do the same thing. And basically you'd become a millionaire by using this particular chain letter. It was a common scam that goes back in time to mail fraud years before, but this was the online version of that. You also started to see targeting of folks trying to get personal identifiable information on some of these message boards, but it was not very intuitive. There weren't a lot of people on it. And so, as is with all cyber matters, to understand this, is as a technology is created, the first people that figure out how to exploit it are criminals. So they figure out, how can I use this basically, essentially, to make money? And then law enforcement, a couple steps down the road, figures out, hey, this is a problem. We should probably address this. So they start figuring out how to try to find the criminals who are already several steps ahead. And then the law tries to catch up after that, saying, okay, we probably need to build a statute so that the law enforcement folks who are trying to arrest these folks have a statute they can convict them on. And then you have the politicians way behind it, worrying about, you know, cow flatulence and other things that probably aren't that pertinent. So they're not really worried about it, which is why you see a lot of folks that are convicted of cybercrimes don't do a lot of time in jail. I used to tell the example in presentations that if you walk into a bank with a gun and you rob it of $600 and you're arrested, you're going to jail for 20 years under a federal crime. And you are going to serve most of that 20 years. There is no parole in the federal system. If you are convicted in the federal system, you will serve the majority of that time. There is no, you won't get out early for good behavior for the most part. But if you hack into a bank and steal $600 million, then you may do a couple years in jail if you are caught. The biggest problem, and I'll probably say this several times in this podcast alone, is the biggest problem the FBI has always had with cyber matters is identifying the person behind the keyboard who's doing the bad things and then finding them, arresting them, and getting them convicted. There is success in this area. There are some of the cases I'll talk about today, people were arrested, people went to jail, but they are more the rarity than they are the more common example. So you're going to see a lot of that. And the other problem is, and I think Scott and I mentioned this in the podcast last week, if you lose money because of an online or some kind of cyber crime scam or something along those lines, specifically business email compromise, which I'll talk about when we get to the 2010s, chances are you're probably not going to get that money back. Now, you can if you report it quick enough and the FBI can get in front of it. You can get some of it returned, but I'll talk about that when I get to business email compromise and some of the more complex financial crimes later in the time. We're 1990. We're not up to that complicated financial theft quite yet. So in 1993, in May of 1993, a 10-year-old boy suddenly went missing from his neighborhood in Brentwood, Maryland. Within weeks, this investigation uncovered two pedophiles and a larger ring of online child pornographers. This is May of 1993. And at that time, this is when the FBI started what would become the Innocent Images Initiative. It was a online undercover program that was designed to identify online pedophiles and basically arrest them and stop them from doing what it was that they were doing. Started in Baltimore, Maryland. Doris Gardner was the first cage agent of this. She bought the first computer associated with the Innocent Images Initiative. Doris was my first supervisor when I was in the Charlotte field office. And hopefully I'm going to have her on a podcast in the near future to talk about the FBI and cyber and specifically Innocent Images. Innocent Images continued for decades, really, working to stop online pornographers. And this is probably the largest violent online crime there is child pornography. It continues on pretty much unabated, regardless of efforts by local and state and federal officials to try to stop it. It is one of the few cyber crimes that local and state law enforcement can readily get involved with and do readily get involved with and do frequently prosecute folks because of it, because it is a largely a federal issue and largely a local issue as well, unlike most of the cases we'll talk about, which are largely federal issues only because state and local law enforcement aren't really posed to stop Chinese attacks into businesses and ransomware and things like that. But Innocent Images is great for all law enforcement in the sense of it is very satisfying work in the sense of you are taking bad people off the streets. There are hard cases to investigate because of some of the images that you have to review as an organizer. But Innocent Images, the targeting of online child pornographers began in 1993. So that was kind of the FBI's first foray into looking at a large scale cyber matter was Innocent Images. Then in a couple years later, Solar Sunrise came around. Solar Sunrise was a code name for an intrusion. Into a Department of Defense network. There was a huge task force put together to try to identify who it was that was in the network. And remember, Title 18, Section 1030 deals with unauthorized access to a computer network or a computer system. And this is what these individuals did. They got into the Department of Defense network. After all the investigation was said and done, it turned out to be a 19-year-old teenager in Israel and two 17-year-old teenagers out of California that had conducted this compromise. Did anyone go to jail? No. So obviously, in the federal system, there is no jail for minors. So the 17-year-olds kind of got talked to, said, don't do that again. It was very bad of you to do those things. Slapped on the wrist and went home with their parents. The 19-year-old Israeli was arrested in Israel He was tried. I believe he got probation, and he would go on to start his own cybersecurity company. He would then do some credit card theft down the line, continued to be somewhat of a cyber criminal. And I believe 2013 is the last they've seen of him. And I'm sure he's still doing bad stuff, but he didn't exactly pay for his crimes, if you will. So that was Solar Sunrise in 1998. That brings us to the 2000s. So not to say that the 90s weren't full of other cyber matters. The problem with the FBI at this time, not the problem, but the issue that the FBI had was they didn't know how to deal with cybercrime, who would investigate it. They didn't have a lot of trained technical folks at the time, because during this time, the FBI hired from an investigative standpoint, a lot of lawyers, a lot of accountants, a lot of foreign language speakers, not a lot of technical folks. There weren't a lot of IT professionals going into the FBI as agents, or at least if they were, they were going to work on drug squads or gang squads. They were not working on cyber squads, because cyber squads did not exist up to this point. Cyber squads started to come around in the late 99 to early 2000s. There were 16 regional cyber squads in the FBI in 2000. However, they were not called cyber squads. We all called them that in the field offices, but they were called the National Infrastructure Protection Center Squad. And I'll tell you right now, as I was on this squad in Charlotte, it was one of the 16. And when you would go to a party and you say, "Hey, I'm an FBI agent," people would say, "Well, that's great. What squad are you on? Are you on a gang squad? Are you on the drug squad? Are you on the counterintelligence squad?" I'd say, "No, National Infrastructure Protection Center." They would look at me and say, "What the hell is that? Are you really in the FBI?" So no one really believed it was a cyber squad, but we called it the cyber squads internally, but that was kind of the name for it. Again, this goes back to the FBI's still trying to deal with what are we doing with this cyber threat problem. So now keep in mind, in 2000, thanks to Al Gore, e-commerce was starting to become a big thing. The World Wide Web was becoming much more worldwide, if you will. There was a lot more access to products. Amazon had started a couple years beforehand. Pretty much every large company had some kind of online presence. And then in March of 2000, Mafia Boy hit, and he did a distributed denial of service against some pretty big companies, CNN, Amazon, I want to say Yahoo, I may be off on that one, but he did. So Mafia Boy, the individual identified as Mafia Boy, was a 16-year-old Canadian kid who had compromised hundreds of thousands of computers all over the world. We call this a botnet. So he was one of the first botnet holders that became at least widely known. So he had compromised these machines, and he used those compromised computers to launch attacks against some of these e-commerce sites. They basically flooded it with enough traffic that they would go offline. Think of the internet as a water pipe. He flushed too much water at the pipes that were going to some of these companies, and it took them offline. Caused them pretty much quite a bit of damage. And I'm have some awareness of this case because I worked the part of it in Charlotte. There was a small community college in North Carolina that he had compromised a couple machines at their college. I had gone and gotten those computers, and we did some forensic images to try to identify information on it. He was ultimately identified. The Canadians went up on a wiretap of his house, and they ended up going in and arresting him, not because of anything he was doing cyberwise, but because in the wiretap, they overheard the father saying he was going to go kill the neighbor. So they decided to go in, arrest everybody, and sort it out afterwards. But Mafia Boy is a pretty infamous name in FBI annals as far as cybercrime goes. And then came the Invita case. And that's not the actual name of the case, but it's the name of the company that was created. Basically, there were two Russian guys who had targeted several different entities. They had done some fraud against Speakeasy Network of Seattle, Washington, the Nara Bank of Los Angeles, some other banks. They had stolen some online credit card information, and they were able to identify that it was two guys out of Russia named Vasily Gorshakov and Alexei Ivanov. Now, tell me Alexei Ivanov is not a Russian name. That is the ultimate Russian name, if you ask me. But they were the undercover, the way it was organized, and several field offices worked on this. I have a friend of mine who worked on part of it in one of these cities. So I'm hoping to have her on in the coming weeks to kind of talk about this case, because she is not allowed to travel to Russia ever because of this case. It's kind of a funny story, but hopefully she can talk about it. But essentially, these two guys looked at themselves as cybersecurity experts. So the FBI created an online undercover opportunity where they created a company called Invita, and they sent an email to these guys saying they were looking for tech folks. And so they enticed these particular gentlemen to come over to the United States to apply for a job. So they flew from Russia over to Seattle, Washington. And when they were there, the FBI agents posing as Invita personnel asked them, "Hey, so you said you're computer experts. Prove to us that you are. Here's a computer. I want to see if you can break into it." So they created a test network. And so these two Russian guys sat down at the computers provided to them. They were able to successfully break into the test network. And then as they were driving back to their hotel, they were pulled over and arrested. Now, what they, unbeknownst to them, the FBI had put a keystroke logger on that particular computer, got their login and passwords to their computer networks back in Russia. The FBI then took that information, hacked back into Russia, got that information, and used that to convict them of these crimes. There's a lot more to this. You can look it up. It is commonly known. Again, it's Invita, INVITA. You'll find it pretty easily. The ironic thing for this is Russia turned around and indicted one of the case agents on this case because he had used the credentials taken from these Russian guys to hack back into their computer in Russia. So Russia saw that as an intrusion into their sovereignty. We're very mad about it. And so that guy is never going to go to Russia either. Ultimately, Gorshkov was found guilty of four crimes, sentenced to 3 years in jail, ordered to pay $692 in restitution, and he's since returned back to Russia. Ivanov would eventually admit to hacking 16 companies. He was also convicted and served 3 years and 8 months in jail and was fined $800,000 in restitution. So this is one of those rare cases where we identified the guy, they came over, and they were arrested and convicted. So that was the Invita case. Again, at the time, the FBI is still working through how do we deal with the cyber threat. This particular case all dealt with unauthorized access to a computer network. There was theft of money. That was not the charge. It was on the unauthorized access to a computer network. In 2002, the FBI finally created the Cyber Division. Cyber Division exists today as one of the main investigative divisions of the FBI. At the same time, there were a couple of units that were created out of that. One was called the one organization formed out of this, it's in Pittsburgh, called the National Cyber Forensics Training Alliance. It is a federal government and private sector alliance that shares threat information about cyber crime activity. Yeah, there's a lot of large companies that provide analysts there to look at emerging cyber crimes, and this is around the time period that was stood up, and it still goes on today. It's still very successful. There's a couple other entities that have formed similar to that. I will not get into those in this particular episode, but the NCFTA was formed around this time. In 2003, there was the Lowe's intrusion. This was a couple guys in Detroit were able to hack the wireless network at a Lowe's store, Lowe's home, the home repair store. And near Charlotte was the headquarters of Lowe's. And so they, from Michigan, they got into the wireless network of this Michigan store, were able to bounce around to point of sale terminals in Florida, and they tried to download a credit card theft tool on that point of sale machine to try to steal credit card information. Well, ultimately, they were arrested, and the leader got 9 years in prison. That was the largest conviction of a cybercrime matter was the Lowe's case. In 2004, 2005, the FBI started looking, in addition to unauthorized access into a computer network, at intellectual property rights theft. So there were two big major cases in 2004, 2005 called Operations Fastlink and SiteDown. These were not just a single case, but it was cases out of several field offices that worked together to take down these large groups that were pirating software, music, movies, games, everything. And these are not just if you're at home downloading a piece of music, you weren't targeted in this, but if you were the group that created that particular copyrighted material or broke the encryption protection and then made Windows 95 or Windows XP available for the world to download for free, that's what these particular cases targeted. Some targeted movie folks that did that gave away compromised movies and things like that. When you look and see the FBI seal on movies, it was around these cases were around that. So in the mid-2000s, the FBI moved their focus to IPR theft for a while. After 2005, they kind of went away from that, largely because of the rise of nation-state actors in 2006, 2007. So Titan Rain was the name of an organized hacking group. It was a code name that was named that by some researchers that identified these Chinese actors that were affiliated with the People's Liberation Army of China. And so they were hacking into national security and other commercial websites, stealing proprietary information. So in 2006, 2007, the FBI started to change its focus from simply criminal cyber matters to now adding nation state and national security related cyber matters into its portfolio of what it dealt with. So at the time, it created what would become the National Cyber Investigative Joint Task Force, which is a multi-agency entity located in Washington, D.C. that the FBI manages and has participation from multiple federal agencies to deal with these type of actors, your Chinese actors, your Russian actors, your Korean actors. It's all largely focused on those particular entities. So Titan Rain was the code name for the Chinese hacking groups. And then something else happened in 2008, which was called Buckshot Yankee. This was a Russian intelligence gathering operation, actually. And what they did was they dropped Russian operatives in Eastern and Western Europe. They dropped thumb drives into the parking lots of DOD facilities. Someone would pick up that thumb drive, take it in, pop it into a computer to see what was on it, and that would run malware and put that on the DOD system. And so now in the DOD, if you are in the DOD, you cannot put a thumb drive into a DOD computer because of this particular case called Buckshot Yankee. No one ever went to jail. No one ever went to jail, was ever arrested for this. Some of these cases I'm going to talk about in this section, no one's ever going to be arrested for, because they all are working on behalf of the states of China, Russia, and so on and so forth. Titan Rain was ultimately identified again in 2011 under a basically called Operation Shady Rat. Shady Rat was a code name made by Mandiant, a cybersecurity company, but it was similar personnel that were associated with Titan Rain as well. And so this is when, during this time frame, the FBI really started looking at nation state activity and started to figure out that cyber was not just a singular problem. It was actually tradecraft for other things. So that's the hard thing, I think, for people to understand when they talk about cyber and how the FBI deals with it, is cyber is not its own thing. I don't know how a better way to say that. I've been saying it like that for years, but basically it's tradecraft for what are already existing crimes. So Innocent Images was targeting online child pornographers. That was already a crime. They're just using computers to do it now. The Invita case were guys that were using computers to steal information. People have been stealing information from other people for a long period of time. It's called theft. And so, again, they're using cyber as a tradecraft to do that. In this case, the Chinese, the Russians, the North Koreans, the Iranians, they are not creating something new by hacking into companies and other federal agencies and things like that. They are stealing information like they've always stolen information. They are just using cyber tradecraft to do that. So in 2006, 2007 is where the FBI started realizing we needed to kind of combine both counterintelligence and cyber into shared intelligence gathering, shared investigative targeting. However, we really wouldn't get there until about 2011, where that finally came to some kind of connection. I'll talk about that in a second. Also, during this time in the mid-2000s, the FBI was really focused on botnets. This, again, going back to Mafia Boy, was folks who had unauthorized access or had compromised thousands and hundreds of thousands of computers all over the world. So there were two big operations by the FBI in 2007. They were called Operation Bot Roast and Operation Bot Roast 2. They basically took down several large botnets and arrested eight individuals that were basically responsible for those botnets. So some success there. Botnets still exist today. Every once in a while, you'll see a botnet takedown, but it's not really a huge priority for the FBI, much like the intellectual property rights theft that I talked about earlier is really not a priority in the sense that you don't see a lot of cases work that, but the nation state stuff is still pretty huge. There was another big case in 2008 that really focused the FBI on theft of financial information, and this was the Royal Bank of Scotland intrusion. Essentially, to narrow this down to talk about as quickly as I can, there were four Russians and an Estonian hacker who hacked into the Royal Bank of Scotland credit card database, and while they were there, they basically stole all the credit card and PIN information for the customers with the Royal Bank of Scotland. they then over the course, and there's a long bit of information on how this occurred. And again, I'll hopefully talk about this in more detail later, but they were able in 24 hours in several countries across the world with folks that were working with them in those countries, accomplices, if you will, they were able to swipe out of the RBS system $10 million in 24 hours. It was one of the largest financial cyber thefts at the time. Ultimately, we were able to identify the folks associated with the hack itself, not so much the swiping of the money. That's a whole different angle to this, but we were worried about the intrusion because they were the ones who caused this to happen. The Estonian target was ultimately arrested and brought back to be tried and convicted. However, no money was ever recovered, and the four Russians still reside in Russia today doing God knows what. So that brought us to about the end of the 2000s. At the time, nation-state activity and theft of credit card and financial information was big at that time. In addition to the FBI doing these cases, the Secret Service had a large play in this as well. The FBI is not the only federal agency that deals with cyber matters. Most of them have some kind of nexus to cyber matters. DHS has a large role. Secret Service still has a role in dealing with credit card theft and things like that, but we kind of work together where we can. But the FBI is still the lead agency for most matters. When it comes to the nation state intrusion activity, the FBI is pretty much the only entity that works those matters. So as we got to 2010, this is where we started to see a rapid hybridization of cyber threats. In other words, it wasn't just theft of money. It wasn't just botnets. It was combinations of all those things, plus an increased use in technology to further the goals of these cyber individuals that were looking to either steal information, steal nation state information, steal financial information, things like that. So in 2011, the FBI started trying to work counterintelligence agents with cyber agents to deal with the nation state actors. I'm not going to talk a lot about that here simply because of particular things I am not allowed to talk about, even though I'm retired from the FBI. But there are a lot of things that occurred from 2010 to now that you're probably aware of. And most of them still kind of are similar in vein to what I've talked about up to this point. Some of them you'll recognize, some of them you may not. So if you ever had a Target credit card in 2013, that was a bad day for you when Target was compromised. Basically, what happened in the Target case, hundreds of millions of Target accounts, Target credit card accounts were compromised. It was a huge problem for Target. The way they got into the system is they had the bad guys had compromised a computer at a heating and air conditioning company. And they knew that that company was the heating and air conditioning company for a Target locally where it was hacked. And the next time that heating and air conditioning company went to that Target to fix their HVAC, when they plugged that computer in to do diagnostics, it launched a code into Target's network that allowed the hacker access to everything that they got access to. It was a huge problem, but it showed the sophistication of where these cyber actors are starting to move. Because of the interconnectivity of everything, it made it a lot easier for bad guys to get access to networks because everybody is now connected. So Target was one of the big cases in 2013 that really started the ball rolling towards a lot of these other things that have occurred since then. Silk Road was a large takedown of a dark web market site that was in the early 2010s, I guess, if you will, 2014, I believe, 2013, 2014. I use that just as an example that hear a lot about the dark web, and people probably think, well, if I go to the dark web, I'm safe. The dark web is nothing more than unsearchable IP space, which anyone, if you know how to get there, you can get there. You just can't Google search how to get to it, but it's there. If there are plenty of sites online that are associated with the dark web or the deep web, and they are not impossible to get to. They're not easy, but if you figure it out, you can get there. So that's where the bad guys went. That's where the FBI went to try to find those folks. And so there are squads that query the dark web and deep web looking for criminal activity and try to take those down. Silk Road is the most infamous of those particular takedowns. And then if you remember around 2014, the Sony hack. So that was a huge compromise of Sony Pictures. And it was by the North Koreans because the North Koreans were mad that Sony, Seth Rogen, the actor, had done a movie called The Interview where they made fun of Kim Jong-un. And so because of that, North Korean hackers hack Sony and cause them a huge amount of damage. This is an interesting case in the sense that They weren't looking for intellectual property from Sony. They weren't really looking to steal any money from Sony. They were just looking to cause Sony some problems because they were mad at what they did. And this was an interesting evolution of the nation state cyber hacker in that he really – it was revenge was his purpose. It was interesting in the sense of the made a lot of news, largely because it was Sony, because the president and some other folks at Sony, their emails had been hacked. It really wasn't a complicated hack. They used phishing to get in, and so they got in, got access to what they needed, and then they made it problematic for Sony to deal with. And I think the president ended up quitting, if I'm not mistaken. But and then there's the Ashley Madison compromise in 2015. And so if you're ever a member of Ashley Madison, that was a bad day for you because your username, your real name, your location were all compromised and then released because there was no ransomware associated with this. But the hackers told Ashley Madison, unless you pay us so much money, we're going to release all this information. Ashley Madison didn't pay them information, and so they released it out. This is where kind of where ransomware was starting to roll around this time. Now, again, this was not ransomware, but it – information held for ransom. And so, and let's talk about ransomware. Now, ransomware is not a new thing. The first documented case of ransomware was in 1989. This is before the FBI knew what to do with the FBI, and it wasn't really a huge problem. It wasn't like there was a lot of money requested or really that there was a lot of data lost. But ransomware has been around for a while. Ransomware is simply software that is launched on a system that encrypts all the data. And if you don't know how to decrypt it, it stays encrypted and you don't have access to it. So you will see ransomware all the time. It's the biggest right now in 2020 is probably the biggest financial problem for companies is ransomware because if there's no way to counter it. Now, there are ways to avoid it if you increase the education of your employees so they understand phishing emails, what not to click on, what to be afraid of, or what not to be afraid of, but what to look for as far as should I open this link? Am I expecting this PDF? I'm expecting this Word document. Do not click the link if you don't have to, because it could cause you a whole host of problems. So ransomware probably right now in 2020 is the biggest issue that we're dealing with. So I'm not going to talk about some of these other things I have on here. I have OPM and I got a couple other things. I'm kind of running out of time, but that is kind of a quick down and dirty view of how the FBI started dealing with cyber matters. In addition to ransomware, business email compromise is a huge thing right now where Scott and I talked about this a little bit last week, but with business email compromise, someone is in your email system, creates an email that looks like it's from someone within the company and gets the payroll department or someone to wire transfer money where it's not supposed to go, and you lose the money. I will probably have an episode on business email compromise specifically down the road to kind of talk about it in more detail, but that and ransomware are probably the two biggest concerns. And nation state actors for companies. For individuals, business email compromise, not so much a big deal for you individually unless you are buying a house. Because in the real estate market, this is where business email compromise has become a big issue, where they get into the email account of the realtor, the title company, maybe the bank. And then if you're looking to close on a house, I know here in Huntsville, the housing market is pretty hot, even with COVID-19 and everything, but people are buying a lot of houses. And so when you go to buy a house, and if you'll get an email from your closing company that says, here's where to wire transfer your closing costs, you want to make sure that you double check with the closing company the routing information. Bad guys are getting into the email accounts of folks associated with real estate transactions and are causing folks to wire transfer their money elsewhere. So again, be aware of that if you're looking to buy a house in the near future. That's just something to be aware of. So where does the future hold? Where are we looking at for 2020? Well, a lot of the cyber threat itself is going to evolve over time. And artificial intelligence is going to be a huge thing in the sense of it being used to further cyber crime, cyber counterintelligence type activity. Because one of the big problems that cyber hackers or cyber actors have overseas is they don't speak very good English. They can't type it out very well or what have you. Artificial intelligence fixes a lot of those things, makes the emails look more legitimate, makes it more likely for you to click on those links and call it that will cause bad things to happen. Your computer to be compromised, ransomware to run or what have you. Work from home is going to be a huge issue going forward, especially as more people now work from home. I kind of mentioned this at the top of the show that obviously you are increasing the attack surface, so that requires a much larger knowledge base of awareness of the threats and how to reduce your vulnerabilities to reduce your risk. Phishing is always going to be a problem simply because it still works. 90% of the cases the FBI currently investigate started because of a phishing attack. Someone clicked a link, caused someone to compromise a network. It gave a bad guy access to that network. That bad guy either being from Russia or a criminal actor looking to steal money, or a nation state actor like from China, Russia, Iran looking to steal national security secrets. Those things still work. That is how they will attack it. Cloud computing is going to become a huge issue as people go to the cloud more. And really, all a cloud is someone else's computer. So when you go to upload or share your store your information on a cloud system, just understand the cloud itself is not any more safe than your own system. It just depends on who it is that you are entrusting that information to. Would I trust my information with Apple or Amazon? Sure. They have as good a security as anybody else, probably better than what I have at home. However, I probably wouldn't go to Ivan's cloud services and store my information there or anything like that. And then smartphone attacks are going to be huge and on the rise as we move forward, because you can't walk around with your computer all the time, although some people do with their laptops and so on, or their iPad Pros and things like that. However, everybody has a smartphone. Everybody's on the smartphone. Everybody's downloading applications to the smartphone. Does that mean you need antivirus and a security suite on your iPhone? Maybe it does. Does it mean you need it on your Android? It absolutely does. If you have an Android device, you should have some kind of security suite on there just to kind of add that protection to that particular phone. You can find that at the Google Play Store. There's plenty of places you can find those type of software programs to protect your Android devices. So that's kind of, again, as a quick down and dirty look at how the FBI has dealt with cyber issues over time. I hope you found it interesting. Like I said, as I go forward, I will bring in folks that dealt with some of these cases, and we'll talk about them in more detail. And so hopefully the next one I'll either have Doris Gardner talking about instant images, or the guy I worked with that we had a big 5-year undercover in Charlotte dealing with intellectual property rights stuff. So we'll have one of those coming up here soon. And finally, I was asked this by my wife, actually, but if you have any questions that you'd like me to try and answer as it pertains to cybersecurity issues, feel free to email me at Darren, D-A-R-R-E-N, at thecyberguy.com. Cyber is spelled C-Y-B-U-R. And I'll try to answer them personally. And if it's a question that can benefit others, I'll use them on a future podcast. So feel free to send those questions to me. If I don't have an answer, I'll look it up and find it for you. Again, I thank those of you who have listened. This podcast is available on my website, thecyberguy.com. It's available on iTunes. I'm working to get it on some other platforms as well, but hopefully you can find it. Again, I thank you for listening. And as you go through your day, make sure that you understand the threats, you assess your risk, and you proceed wisely. Thank you. Have a safe week, and appreciate you downloading.